interviews with artists, activists, scholars, and a host of other experts each episode. Listen Wednesdays at 1 p.m. Africa Now is also available on iTunes Podcast, Google Play Music, as well as SoundCloud on your station for Jazz and Justice, WPFW, Washington.
Welcome to WPFW Washington. You're tuned in at 89.3 FM on your dial and possibly through the internet at WPFWFM.org. This is the Hour of We the People. I'm your host, David Whetstone. And as always, I thank you for tuning in. And I thank those new and long-term supporters who have supported this Jazz and Justice radio station for over 48 years. It's not an accident. It is because of your dedication that we can thank you. On today's show, we're going to talk about preserving and maintaining culture. We often use the terms culture and sometimes even culture wars, but what does culture really mean? Why is it important to pay careful attention to this notion and even actively take care of this aspect of life? To answer those questions and to tell us more, James Counts Early is the former Smithsonian Institution Assistant Secretary for Education and Public Service. His previous positions include Director of Cultural Heritage Policy at the Center for Folklife and Cultural Heritage, Community Program Associate at Howard University's Institute for Arts and Humanities, and the Interim Director of the Anacostia Community Museum. Mr. Early also serves on the editorial board of the International Journal of Heritage Studies and on the boards of the U.S. Chapter Association of Critical Heritage Studies and the Institute for Policy Studies. He actively consults on issues regarding cultural democracy and concerns of the African diaspora. Mr. Early, thank you for being with us, Brother Early.
I'm always pleased to join the Pacifica Network, specifically in now my hometown of Washington, D.C., WPFW, and urge people to send in their support and put their voices forward, not just to listen.
Because we want every voice to be heard. That's the only way in listen management that we can build better communities and a better world one broadcast at a time. Well, I sort of stumbled through our introduction, and I mentioned culture and heritage and your positions constantly. So what I want to know to begin with is, how do we refer to you? How do we embrace your discipline to get ready for listening to this conversation?
Well, I'm a self-described professional eclectic. So my history, somewhat aimlessly, has involved a number of areas of disciplinary study with not very profound or in-depth participation in any of them. So I've been engaged with a lot of different things, but not really grounded in any one thing in specific. If there is a constant theme on reflection of both my personal evolution from my childhood into my adulthood and the intersection with my professional encounters, community-based culture, ways of knowing and doing that are historically evolved and socialized from one generation to the next, sets my sort of experiential definition of culture. Although I've looked at the works of very profound intellectual and thinkers and academics like the Jamaican Marxist Stuart Hall, who is one of the principals in the development of cultural studies with Hogarth and Raymond Williams, who have done really profound analysis and comparison. For me, culture is one of, as Raymond Williams pointed out, is probably one of the most difficult terms, one of the three most difficult terms, I think he said, in the English language to define. People generally conflate the term culture and art, in my view, and I think art is a subset of culture, and it's elevated to an independent factor because of the powerful communicative and evocative and engaging nature of artists, musicians, poets, visual artists, sculptors, and dancers, and the like. And culture, in my view, is often one-dimensionally used to suggest virtuous affirmative perspectives. Culture is something positive. I think there are negative dimensions of socialized, learned behavior like chauvinism, like racism, like homophobia. And people have deep philosophical, analytical thoughts. And in line with people like Stuart Hall, suggests then the power of culture, that its power is culture is political. In my view, first of self-governance, what are the ways of knowing and doing that one either is born into and socialized in and affirms, or one differs with the context in which one is born and raised. So culture has both a virtuous positive dimension of a respectful recognition of the historical ways of knowing and doing on the positive humanistic side of different cultures. And then there are the clash of cultures, those characteristic learned behaviors and symbols and expressions that one group is distinct in relationship to the historical evolved ways and affinities of another group, in which one group sees itself as more virtuous, as dominant, as more civilized. And therein repressive of other groups. So it's a complex arena. People talk about dance and art and so forth as culture, but I see these as embodiments of culture, expressions of culture, forms of culture, genres of culture. But culture is more meaning and thinking and engaging in broader, more dynamic ways from my experiential vantage point.
Well, your extensive anger. Pardon me, answer, I need to enunciate, evokes quite a bit and brings us up to date. Again, the word bubble or association going from my mind, and I imagine the mind of listeners, are ethnicity, institutions, tradition. Did I say ritual? Did I?
Yes, ritual. Religion.
Food, religion, yes. The things of everyday life. And as they are intra and interpersonal too, I think.
Yes,
So to
yes.
be forthright with you, one of the reasons for the invitation to this hour is we are certainly in the midst of not only a debate about culture, but a fierce struggle over it. It does not set well. It's still in people's memories and minds, the firing of Dr. Carla Hayden, the first African-American and first woman librarian of Congress. That's more than just symbolic to fire her, to terminate her. We've certainly had a rich last two decades of banned or challenged books as well. And we have an outright political campaign by a present administration against diversity, equity, and inclusion. And so it's with those remarks that that I hope are somewhat reflected in our further conversation. It may be redundant, but probably we need to give listeners reasons why there needs to be an active stewardship or tending over not only one's culture, but the whole notion of culture.
Well, as I point out that from my vantage point, culture is fundamentally historical, evolved ways of meaning and knowing and doing and identity and guidance or governance over how one enters the world. Within a particular, one particular culture, I would suggest that male chauvinism is a characteristic learned behavior. It's not a biological imperative, and which, notwithstanding the issues of colonization or white supremacy, white male-dominated Christian perspectives, that within a community, even as they fight against the diminishing or the dismissal or the control of other historical ways of knowing and doing, which might be indexed by race or ethnicity, there is the gender issue, even as one is fighting against the culture war of another dominant group, one has to acknowledge what are the historically evolved differences within a community of women vis-a-vis men. So culture is complex in that regard. It's not an atomized, centralized culture A in distinction or culture A versus culture B.
Yeah, it's not simple mathematics, in other words.
No, it's not simple mathematics. Within culture A are these gender evolved differences. Then there are the class differences. Folk culture, which I would describe as grassroots, non-formal educational or university-trained expressions, the blues, with Sterling Brown, the great poet and literary scholar and first poet laureate of Washington, D.C., although coming from a solid middle-class, formally educated community, having studied both European and more recognized New Negro and Harlem Renaissance literary figures, really identified himself with the barbershops and the streets and the storytellers and the stories about rural life. And from that vantage point, there is the class element that I think relates characteristically to the notion of folk cultures versus just racial culture. Stephen Henderson, Understanding the New Black Poetry, the late chairman of the English department at Morehouse College when I entered Morehouse in 1965, who came to Howard University in 1971, in the construct of the Black University, which Dr. Cheek at that point was trying to propagate, was the founding director of the Howard University Institute for the Arts and Humanities, I think quite accurately in looking at the work of Sterling Brown, for example, from the vantage point of what is culture, talked about the class nature that Sterling picked up in the context of the caste construct of Black America, which would suggest that irrespective of how formally educated and articulate and creative certain elements of the Black community was, the racial divide of American apartheid was a cultural war of looking at these are less than acceptable expressions based simply on the skin color of the individual. But within that context of the quote unquote black immunity, there was then the class issue. And I suggest that one can find this in all manners of culture, notwithstanding the fact that many African Americans, in fighting against the absolutism of white supremacy, of being the apex of human expression, like to talk about we are descendants of kings and queens. I then raise the question, in that hierarchical status, who were the peasants? Who were the less dominant, learned behavioral cultural expressions passed on from one generation to next, who were not the kings and queens?
Well, you offer a lot in your response. Let me, as they say, kick the bobo or chop it up with you further. The previous broadcast, we focused on Hubert Harrison, and I was delighted to have our guest capitalize on his commitment to educate on the corner of 135th Street and Lenox Avenue. In other previous broadcasts, again, to my pleasure, our guest capitalized on a number of things. Carter G. Woodson, meeting regularly with coal miners, probably in barbershops like Dr. Sterling Brown. W.E.B. Du Bois' opening of The Soul of Black Folks rejoices in his privilege of encountering and educating young children. The dedication of Anna Julia Cooper to the education of just about every black child that came under her care. And of course, we have broader phenomena, whether it's Mary McLeod Bethune, the establishment of universities and colleges that are known as HBCUs, and so on and so forth. And so it is within our ethos, upon reflection, it is in our behavior that we see these crossings of class, colorism, this wrestling with all this. I'm tempted to ask a question too early on. How is this to be maintained, at least from a historical point of view? But you can engage that question in any way you like.
It is to be maintained, I think, first and foremost, by looking at what are the motive forces in the actual lives of people that give rise to artistic and sense-making perspectives. And I use sense-making here as a kind of common sense, everyday dimension of intellectuality. And everyone is an intellectual. That is, we all are sense-makers.
So we're learners and teachers.
Yeah, and we're teachers. So that in the oral tradition of people who cannot read or write, it does not mean that they do not code the world in very profound ways, because reading and writing are particularized expressions of meaning and knowing and feeling and practice. And so that someone like Sterling Brown talked about the blues, or someone like W.E.B. Du Bois in 1903 writing The Souls of Black Folk, as a Harvard University trained a person who looked at his Dutch heritage as well as his black heritage and recognized that he was a capital I sense maker, a capital I intellectual. He points out on these sorrow songs and The Souls of Black Folk, "Least one be confused, I am bone and bone and flesh of those behind the veil." And he meant those who were toiling well outside of the European dominating construction and the historically evolved descendants of enslaved Africans who were engaged in a multicultural, that is a multiple reading, not only of their own racial and familial background, a familial and racial background, but who are also ensconced in the coding of Europe. And so that one needs to, the caution here is simply to see these as essentialized distinctions, but to understand the inner dynamics of designated self-identified communities vis-a-vis designated other communities. You mentioned Mary Cloud Bethune, who talked about her relationship to Africa, although she was on a hierarchical integration movement into the broader society. Lifting as we climb was her connection from where her antecedents had come, if not her directly, herself.
Well, on that pause, allow me to reintroduce you. Listeners, you're listening to We the People. I'm your host, David Whetstone. But I always say this, more importantly, I would have you focus on our topic, preserving and maintaining culture, and to listen deeply to our guest, James Counts Early. Mr. Early, I'm going to take some liberties here because at this point I got to condense your bio. I would say you're a cultural activist and advocate that is interdisciplinary in nature and in comportment also. That's a signal to people who understand the word comportment. and I'm thank you for your signifying laugh there. It's a gesture of gratitude for you being not only on the show, but doing the work that you're doing. Your last answer moved me to, again, I'm rushing these questions, think of the political. And I want to wrestle with a historical antecedent, the politics of respectability. What do you do if you're a man or a woman or a non-binary person? You've worked your way up through a group. You're working with a group, a collective of people. You're in a role of leadership, and you're concerned about these issues, particularly of colorism and class, especially the latter, which is active in the environments that we're in. Particularly, we're broadcasting from Washington, D.C. This would be a place, an historical nexus or location of the whole issue of the politics of respectability. You have this strong, powerful, aspirational moving upward class for whatever motives, whatever reasons, trying to take care of people who are less socially well off. And then we're now possibly 100 years and then some later, especially young people looking back on these ages, and they hear this term politics of respectability, and it offers some sniping. In other words, rich folk were trying to control poor folk under a condition of political oppression. I think you're sensing what I'm getting at here.
Yes.
What do we do about, I didn't want to vulgarize it, but the whole navigation, the whole commerce of culture, especially within our communities?
Well, because the human species is one of individual will, notwithstanding the socializing pressures of convention in a society, culture is about change. Culture is about imagining, not of new possibilities in relationship to what has historically been evolved. Culture is alive, it's not static. I think recognizing that dynamic and how it actually unfolds within individuals in a group and how associative groups within a racial or ethnic or gender background evolve is to be honest about that and to not essentialize it.
What do you mean by that? I want to make sure listeners really understand that.
So there are those who would say, because of the color of our skin, we are African, which is one index of where our antecedents and their plurality evolved from. Consider that Africa is probably the continent of the most dynamic of the less than several thousand living languages, language being a fundamental index of worldview, of how one codes the world, about one's cosmological views, one's gender views, one's views about agriculture or cattle raising or other perspectives. There is no one white person in terms of cultural background. I know one genesis of Black people. It is the historical political dominance of indexing skin color to dominate and exploit the resources and the mental and physical ability of another group that leads us to this absolutizing. So Eurocentrism and white supremacy and male dominance are essentialist kinds of perspectives that they are better than people not of white skin background, and dominance over women, even including in the context of white supremacy. So there is a complexity that needs to be unraveled about how individuals under any designation of self-identity have contradictory and competitive dynamics within that group. None of that simply atomizes the notion of culture, that is to spread it out at 1,000 points of light, because it is gelled in power relations or politics, the power of definition, the power of one's imagination to define oneself. Afrocentrism being one of those expressions that exceeds the traditional characteristic backdrop of what is Black literature in the context of the United States, or what is African literature, or the decision to write in quote unquote tribal African languages, notwithstanding the lingua franca under colonialism in a particular country being English or French, which gives you larger access to the global public space, including often in one's own nation. So that culture is demanding of analysis, and it is cautionary about jumping to quick conclusions. Let me just tie that, because I'm not sure I went to, at least my vantage point, a perhaps baseline on the issue of preserving. So we have to look at the cultural creators. And this generation, under Sterling Brown's generation, for example, or Langston Hughes, the blues, the most marginalized, economically exploited, and physically tortured and dismissed dimensions of the Black community expressed their worldview fundamentally in a blues line. Go back to Amiri Baraka on the blues people, and where he uses the term the evolution, the emergence of the Negro, which people have problems with that term. But what Baraka is trying to say to us is that, yes, this has an African backdrop, but which African backdrop? We now know there are 54 countries on the continent of Africa and thousands of ways of knowing and doing in terms of languages and ethnic groups and religious expressions. So there is no oneness in that regard. And it is European absolutism of white supremacy and colonization saying that they were one and dominant, notwithstanding the exploitation of white working class people, for example, in Appalachia, which produces a different kind of cultural expression than cosmopolitan New York or very liberalized California. So we have to go to who are the creators, the imaginary people. While it may have been blues in the time of Langston Hughes and Sterling Brown and the like, hip hop. Remember the debate? I forget her name of the, I don't know if she was on the Washington City Council, of looking at the vulgar expressions of hip hop.
Dolores Tucker is probably.
Dolores Tucker, that debate. Skip Gates in defending, was it Two Lives Crew that Skip Bates in the legal formation defended? As freedom of expression. So this is within the Black community that we see individualized perspectives about what is virtuous and what is not virtuous. But I would venture to say that this generation, my children, an odd term in the English language, are almost 50 and 46 years of age. They are not of the blues generation. They're of the hip-hop imaginative dimensions, and they tend to align themselves with the more progressive, transgressive, democratizing elements of hip-hop, rather than the male chauvinist, bitches and hoes kind of perspectives, which is also culture, but it is the negative, not wholesome, community, humanistic building dimensions of culture. So these are some of the complexities and the contradictions. And in terms of preserving, then one, what gets institutionalized and by whom and what perspective in archives and museums and university departments and study departments and the like are questions of preservation.
Well, your answer not only opens up that question, but a whole world of questions. But we have to do our due diligence in managing the show, and the clock is upon us. We're at the halfway point of We the People. I'm your host, David Whetstone. We are talking to James Count Early, about the whole notion of preserving and maintaining culture. And we're trying to do the largest reach possible in having that discussion. We at WPFW believe in building a better world, a better communities, one broadcast at a time. There are over 100 programmers that do that. Part of our service to you through Jazz and Justice is also to bring you public service announcements. So I ask you to hang on to this point in the dial, stay with us, and we'll continue our conversation shortly after this break. Thank you for listening.
Stay Jazzy up. Sundays at Anacostia, an 8-week jazz and R&B concert series happening this Sunday, 4 to 6 p.m. in the heart of the Anacostia Arts District at 1234 Marion Barry Avenue. Food vendors will be on site and lawn chairs are welcome. Jazzy Sundays in Anacostia runs through Sunday, September the 7th. Details at anacostiabid.org.
And welcome back to We the People right here at WPFW 89.3 FM, WPFWFM.org. In this hour, we've been talking about the whole notion of culture, its preservation, its maintenance, its sustainability, and how culture sustains us. We've been doing that with James Counts Early, the former Smithsonian Institution Assistant Secretary for Education and Public Service. Not his claim, but my way of describing him to you would be that Mr. Early is sort of a cultural activist, advocate, curator. And I think it's just, and I'm that it's marvelous that we just have you in this hour, Mr. Early, just to be frank with you. Your last remarks before our break have many extensions, many insinuations. I think in our best of days, what we want to do with culture is to recognize it, respect it, acknowledge it, value it, encourage it, empower it, and celebrate it. And that's not an abstraction. That's about people dealing and living with people. We ended on some of the challenges that surround the notion of culture. We definitely have made reference to cross-generational things. I appreciate in your answer that it's our duty to convey those things of culture. Often people think of maintaining and locking in place tradition or some set ideology. But I think it's, upon reflection, I think most people would sensitively say it's trying to preserve community. It's trying to affirm our humanity. And you were quite insistent, and rightly so, that culture changes over time and ought to. My question to you then is, we want to accentuate the positive, but we're in a terrible time where people are actively trying to destroy cultures. Particularly, these people are not in the political majority, or they're in a numerical minority, or they're marginalized, or they've already been pre-victimized. Can you just talk a little bit about your observations? You're very well traveled across this globe. How people deal and preserve in a rich culture to the benefit of all?
Well, let's start with really a urgent issue in the nation's capital of the United States of America, which is the political capital, that is the governance capital of 300 and some odd million people. And the attacks on the Smithsonian Institution, whose simple but profound mandate is the increase in diffusion of knowledge among men, unquote, was its initial vantage point, which is now, because of the nature, the political nature of culture, of women fighting along with men allies to recognize the socialization of women is not characterized essentially by their biology, but how they have been positioned in the sociology of power, if you will, that we now talk about the increase in diffusion of knowledge among many different expressions of Homo sapiens who are of different cultures and different languages
Yes.
and different religions. So the attack on the Smithsonian Institution, I think it's quite instructive that the front door of that attack is on the African American, the National Museum of African American History and Culture, and its founding director, Dr. Lonnie Bunch, who is former chief curator of the National Museum of American History. And because American history historically, that museum was Eurocentric in its orientation, male dominance in its orientation, and not inclusive as it should be of the various other cultural expressions indicated by indigeneity and racial and ethnic backgrounds, Latinos, women, etc., then it gave rise to a political movement, a governance movement, a self-determined movement of me too. Here is my socialized way of being, and it is rich and complex enough that a museum, actually several museums, could be sustained on that. So that the frontal attack on the Smithsonian Institution is highly racialized, and that there is a movement to protect the emergence of the National Museum of American History and Culture, which dates back to the Civil War, of Black soldiers involved saying, we want to be recognized in a museum. And it's gone through various proposals over the years. But that front door attack, racialized attack, is going horizontal. It's going against the proposal of a new women's museum there, of a Latino museum there, led by right-wing Cubans who are on the Board of Regents of the Smithsonian, the policy-making platform of the Smithsonian, to stand to bring their essentialized view of what Latinos should be. I think we have to then understand the power of culture, the politics of culture in that regard. There is a movement of a white supremacist, Eurocentric, male Christian orientation as the official ways of knowing and behavior in the United States, which might be accepting in secondary and tertiary elements of other historically evolved cultures, which involves people, Black people, Latinos, gay and lesbian people who are also supporting this white supremacist Eurocentric view. This is the complexity of culture, and it's a cautionary tale against over-centralizing. There is the
Thank you.
cultural.
Again, and just since we're in the second half of the show, essentializing being you particularize a standard and you say that standard's above all others. Is that a
That
good?
standard above all others, and that if you are of a particular group, this is how you should think
It's normative, it's
and
controlling.
comport yourself or carry
Yeah.
yourself. And therein, if you don't do it in the way that is pronounced, you are a traitor, as though there is some inherent predetermined, naturalized expression that because of the color of your skin or your gender or your sexual preference, this is how you should act. There is a danger in that because even in among oppressed and exploited groups, with that kind of characterizing, essentializing that this is what it means to be male or this is what it means to be female or what it means to be black. Those are very dangerous constructions that limit the imagination of the individual because it all redounds to what, who are the individuals in a group? Things don't change unless new imaginative perspectives come forward. They don't come through, these imaginative perspectives don't come forward by consensus voting. It comes through the power of the individualized voice who amalgamates other interests, other affinities.
The
So
individual to the
Baraka
collective,
breaks
yes.
through. June Jordan is not
Breaks
to be
through.
conflated with every Black writer of her generation. She is a distinct voice. And while she and Alice Walker may have many convergences, Nikki Giovanni may have many convergences, within that grouping, these are highly individualized voices. Mary Baraka and A.B. Spellman, A.B. Spellman in his 90s in Washington, D.C., who brings us avant-garde jazz critique in Four Lives in the Bebop World, is an individual voice. He is not to be conflated with his classmate, Mary Baraka, notwithstanding the various intersections and the impact that he says Mary Baraka had on him. They are yet distinct voices. So these are things in the preservation and in the moment. These are not abstract questions. There is an attempt to erase these democratic expressions. That is demos, we the people, krasia, the power of different historically evolved perspectives to be a part of a mainstream official culture. There is an attempt to erase that, book burning, lies that are turning narratives that slaves were happy and it's better to have been enslaved than to have remained on the continent of Africa.
With the added also annotation that they didn't know anything, that they didn't do anything, and they needed the training, which is just so terribly offensive.
Right, which then attempts to attack that the crucible of American democracy, that is the test case, just simply look at the legal entities, the challenge of these descendants of enslaved Africans to make the Constitution actually reflective of the way that the society should work against how it was working, set precedent for other exploited and discriminated groups, including upper-class white women who were not property owners, who were subservient to a male perspective of the way that the world should work, a male perspective of what is good, truth, and beautiful as foundational elements of one's being. And so that we are in that attempt now to resegregate America and to diminish these other voices and to actually turn the children of those heroic fighters into expressions of Eurocentrism, a centralized Eurocentrism. Everything Europe produced is not bad. But to say that that is the apex of cultural expression, then is to try to eradicate the different ways of knowing and doing that we have historically expressed and fought to be a part of official designation of what is good, truth, and beautiful, who are acceptable human beings, and what is virtue. And so that we're in under a huge attack, because if you can name the world, then you can claim it. But if someone names it for you, then you are subservient to their vantage point. So the attack on the economy is in concert with the attack on ways of knowing and doing, as expressed in the Library of Congress, as expressed in the Smithsonian Institution. Notwithstanding contradictions in both of those institutions, we have fought not just to be a part of it, but we have fought to transform them. And we have transformed the curriculum throughout. This is where Black Studies, again, is the crucible, a test case that opened up the avenue for other centric expressions, Latino-Chicano studies, women's studies, the second iteration of the women's movement, was empowered and energized by the civil rights movement. And so these are urgent matters, not just esoteric or academic discursive matters to talk about. They really strike at the heart of our very being and self-identity.
The voice that you're hearing, the comments that you're hearing are from James Counts Early. We're talking about culture right here on We the People, right here on WPFW 89.3 FM, WPFWFM.org, in existence for more than 48 years because you or listeners like you choose to give us social and financial support that has kept that long tenure going, and I thank you for that. There are plenty of good reasons to listen to WPFW, your Jazz and Justice radio station. For instance, on this day, at 3 o'clock, Sophie's Parlor, done by one of the oldest established women's collectives on public broadcasting. Music and culture by women before everyone. At 2 o'clock, Zen El Amin, Shea Wanana, pardon me, talks about Middle Eastern affairs. At 1 o'clock, producers and host James Pope and Melissa Mutali talk about things regarding people of African descent, not only on the continent, but throughout the world, throughout the diaspora, whether it's economics, history, politics, environment, culture. They cover it all, quite frankly. And last but not least, during the week at every noontime hour, we do not forget the blues with various hosts. The Wednesday edition is hosted by Clarence the Bluesman Turner. All these are very, very good reasons to encourage you to listen to WPFW. Our time has quickly passed, Mr. Early. Brother James, if you could, let's just end on the note of how do we deliberately sustain culture, particularly in these difficult times? What does it mean to have the engagement of elders and young people in this struggle? What does it mean to think of oneself as part of a community that will continue beyond this present chapter?
Notwithstanding the threat against different ways of expression and intelligence, we must find the culture makers, that is, those individuals and groups who are reflective of larger interests and lifestyles and life ways of different communities. And we must go and engage them, critically engage them and organize with them, both in defense of their creativity, but critically engaging to make sure that we're getting the most wholesome expressions. Hip hop would be one example. No matter what one thinks of it, it is. There may come a time that there will be programs, Don't Forget Hip Hop, but we are not. Forget the blues is an indication that while blues is still a rich cultural expression, it is not the dominant mode of marginalized and working class or even middle class elements of the African American community as it once was. So we have to find them. We have to go where the museologists are. We have one of the richest, powerful community expressions of museology ever in the history of the United States, perhaps the world, in the Anacostia Neighborhood Museum, started by John Kennard, a Black minister and members of his community who had no museological training, who criticized, quote unquote, that racist Smithsonian, but wanted to be a part of it, and leveraged that institution to develop what became the prototype of the American Neighborhood Museum, which means that out of the particularities of the expressions of the Anacostia community at that time arose an orientation, approach, and methodologies that could be applied to any communities, including white American or indigenous communities. But it was out of the particularity of the Black experience that this universal, it's the finding the universal in the particular, an old philosophical
and operating framework. As sophisticated, say, in different modalities, different venues, different places.
Yes.
And then those places.
And it is under threat. Congress is now, this administration is saying it will not fund the Anacostia
Community Museum anymore.
Right. So while we stand in defense of the Smithsonian National African American Museum, Anacostia is a distinct museological expression that intersects this national, global, monumental construct of the National African American Museum of History and Culture. But we must go and collaborate with them in defense of what has been accumulated and on offense of what we need to create tomorrow, not just defending ourselves, but continuing to figure out how we give frameworks and platforms to these new creative voices.
You know, I'm aware of something.
Where the culture makers are, if you will, suggest.
Yeah. In fact, the model this last point that you're making, I believe the present exhibit or something that that can be accessed at the Anacostia Community Museum is Black Women's Voices.
I think yes.
That's a current offering that has the actualities of Black women in different modes of life, I believe here in D.C., but also elsewhere, if I'm not mistaken. You know,
so we're a high-resolution community in the context of the United States because the MAGA movement and the Trump movement in power, in governance power, wants to change Washington, D.C. to be their expression, which means it's anti the Black American experience here and the allies of the Black American experience here. which is given a distinct element of ways of knowing and doing and expression in this nation's capital. We're not just another community in the United States. We are this physical territory is the site, it's the political capital of U.S. capital and its imperial expansions around the world. New York might be the economic center, but here is the governance center, which comes out with officialdom of what is acceptable, good, truth, and beautiful, and by whom. And so we have a particular battleground here that has implications for the nation, and I would venture to say the globe, because the African American Museum as an expression is worldly recognized, as is the National Museum of the American Indian, which probably is the second sui generis distinction of museology that is self-developed after the Anacostia museological experience at the Smithsonian Institution. These are things I would leave you with to get on the battlefront of not only defense, but going on the offense, because we have new voices, new imaginations percolating in our communities that need to even change these institutions more so than they have against the history of colonialism and the history of white supremacy.
You know, one thing that you're making clear, and we do have a few more moments to, pardon the expression, squeeze things out. Okay. People deserve and have a right to exist. I would say human life needs to flourish without qualification. What is it that if one was willing to listen and to listen to this hour and your appeals, how do we get across that this is a benefit for everyone? Because one of the main real politic tricks is that this stuff's so particularized that these people just want to, dare we confess, that they want to do what we've done. They want to dominate and eliminate our culture. How can we answer that back? How can we show that that is not the case?
I think honest, critical engagement, not simple recognition that people have a right to say or do what they want to, because it can be injurious to other groups or it can be uplifting to other groups. I think critical engagement and debate and compromise. And compromise in its best expression is, how do we get the mutual benefit of our different ways of knowing and doing and respectfully continue our debate of what where our differences are without being injurious to the actual lives of the people expressing these differences? So the word critical engagement, participatory critical democracy, that is always challenging other views to see what you might learn and what you might contribute, and being principled and honest and surrendering when it comes clear to you that, wow, my view is not the most wholesome view. It does not mean that you are a bad person, because there are no perfect people. It's only out of critical engagement that we extract the best of the human imagination and the best of what we call the cultural expressions. And I'll stop on this point. Culture, from my vantage point, and I'm not the only one who's thought this and others have thought more deeply than I, is culture is the context of life. It is not a simple element of life. So economics come out of that. Dance, anthropology, the social sciences, political constructions about democracy. These are all cultural expressions, that is, imaginative views that are turned into standard institutional frameworks, and that they are ever-changing because the imagination is the engine of culture, and we are always imagining new possibilities and fighting, I mean literally fighting, to be able to bring them into view, as is the case of Palestinians against the apartheid, occupational, essentialized position in the constitutional constructs of Israeli voted in, not just Netanyahu, but the majority of Israelis who are voting have voted in an apartheid, a second-class citizenship. Some of them are against the genocide, but they are not for the full equality of those Palestinians who would like to live in harmony, but in distinction with the rest of humanity. And so these are the urgent questions about culture. They're not secondary. They are really the primary context out of which all other life-defining elements of marriage.
Thank you, James Counts Early, for your discussion of culture right here on We the People. My thank also goes to the News and Public Affairs Department at WPFW, our engineer, Mike Nasella, and importantly, you, the listener. We are so grateful that we have folks that sustain us socially and financially. I cannot say that enough. So thank you for listening in this hour. Perhaps we'll meet again over the radio sometime soon. Until then, take good care.
African Diaspora International Film Festival, Africa World Now Project, and GWU Africana Studies Program present the 18th Annual African Diaspora International Film Festival DC, August 1st to the 3rd, featuring a film on Walter Rodney, films on Black musical traditions, and more. Receptions and Q&As, ADIFFDC from August 1st to the 3rd at the GWU Student Center. Tickets and schedule at nyadiff.org or at 212-864-1760. ADIFF, where Black Life Matters. WPFW, building a better world one broadcast at a time.
Award-winning former police officer and criminal justice adjunct professor Garland Nixon hosts News Views Fridays at 6 p.m. Tune in to hear a refreshing angle on today's state of affairs and other issues other media intentionally overlook. Find the episodes on iTunes Podcast and Google Play Music. Only on your station for Jazz and Justice, 89.3 FM, Washington.
To get WPFW swag in your life? Items that say, I support Jazz and Justice without saying a word. We've got you covered. Details and browsing at WPFWFM.org. Again, that's WPFWFM.org.
From August 3rd through the 16th, during our summer pledge drive, we present WPFW, 48 Years of Centering Blackness. We'll commemorate Black August and celebrate not only the freedom fighters, political prisoners, and those who have perished in the struggle for Black liberation, but also the scholars, musicians, and poets whose work has served the Black liberation struggle. There are forces working to erase the contributions and significance of Black people. Your contribution ensures that WPFW is not erased and that the voices of Black people throughout the diaspora continue to be platformed here. Donations can be made anytime at WPFWFM.org. WPFW, building a better world, one broadcast at a time.
Jazzy Sundays in Anacostia, an 8-week jazz and R&B concert series happening this Sunday, 4 to 6 p.m. in the heart of the Anacostia Arts District at 1234 Marion Barry Avenue. Food vendors will be on site and lawn chairs are welcome. Jazzy Sundays in Anacostia runs through Sunday, September the 7th. Details at anacostiabid.org.
The Birchmere presents Switch, August 10th, and Jazz Funk Soul featuring Jeff Lorber, Everett Harp, and Paul Jackson Jr., August 13th, Mesa, August 17th, and Eric Robertson, August 23rd and 24th. Details at birchmere.com.
American Music Association will honor Dr. Salim Hilton for his community service and career in restorative justice, youth development, and entertainment on Thursday, August 7th, 5 to 9 p.m. at the Country Club at Woodmore, 12320 Pleasant Prospect, Mitchellville, Maryland. Details available by calling Beverly Lindsay Johnson at 202-552-0000. We'll be right back.
the collision.
The Collision, where sports and politics smash, Thursdays at 10 a.m. and on iTunes and Google Play. WPFW, Washington, D.C.